The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics.
This week's episode is sponsored by Newgate.
Hello and welcome to Polling Politics. I'm Joe Twyman from the political pollster's Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie Leconte.
Every week, Marie and I round up the key political stories and statistics of the week. And we're also joined by a top guest from the world of politics to delve into the world of polling, public opinion and everything that's going on in the Westminster bubble.
And also weirdly sex robots quite often.
We'll gloss over that. In the news this week, Sir Kim Darroch. Is that how you pronounce it? Darroch? Darroch?
So I have, fun fact, I have managed to talk about this story with so many people this week without saying his name once because I am not entirely sure how you say it. So the ambassador, or he, are how I've been referring to him.
Yes, the Ferrero Rochers have run out for Sir Kim.
Our man in Washington.
Isabel Oakeshott in the Mail on Sunday published leaked diplomatic communications that showed that Sir Kim had communicated with Whitehall that President Trump is perhaps not the stable genius he claims to be. This has caused many problems.
I don't know. I feel like, you know, and I feel like I kind of like I've been saying that every week for about 3 years now. But it has been so tiring. Like the entire discourse around that has been incredible. Like people apparently, you know, had never heard of the concept of diptels before, and are like, "What?" He was quite rude in his assessments. Like, what do you think ambassadors and diplomats do? Like, what
eat
do
you? Ferrero Rocher. This is set out very clearly every Christmas in the adverts.
But, you know, the whole, what was it, Dominic Raab on Newsnight kind of saying, you know, the like, what was it, like the language he used was poor, something along those lines. Just incredible, incredible. That is, I do not want this to be a ranty podcast because I think we're just mostly good-natured, very, very funny people. But also, I feel neither good-natured or funny about this. It's just so infuriating and so frustrating.
I think what's particularly frustrating is the idea that he would say something different from any ambassador for France or Germany in Washington reporting back to their people. But, of course, it wasn't so much that's more recently attracted the headlines. It was Donald Trump's response that, of course, kept the momentum on this going. He effectively froze out Sir Kim from future events, didn't invite him to a dinner, and then Sir Kim resigned earlier this week.
To be fair, I think he was left no choice at this point. You know, and obviously, I wish we could live in a world where the past week hadn't happened, he hadn't had to resign, but at this point, I'm not sure what else he could have done.
So the key question is there more to it than this? Is this actually about a wider axis of Trump, Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, as has been suggested? Was this a link within the civil service? And if so, why was that leaked?
I'm not sure. I think, because again, I have found this story just so unbearable to follow. But the one thing that I could not stop thinking about is how stressed the leaker must be right now. Because, you know, like it keeps escalating of like, you know, the police is involved. Like, I think that was it, like the police involved in like DC as well. You know, is this massive thing and everyone piling on to be like, this is like the worst leak that's ever happened. We'll find the person. Can you imagine how stressed that person is right now?
Are we sure it wasn't Gavin Williamson again?
Genuinely, that would be the only thing that would make the story for me. I would be happy again. I really hope it was Gavin Williamson because that would be really funny. Though I think on the other stress thing as well, and I can't remember who pointed it out on Twitter originally, but on top of just being very, very stressed because everyone, you know, is kind of out to get the leaker, also that person is the source of Isabel Oakeshott, of all the journalists. And being Isabel Oakeshott's source, I think, must be quite a stressful thing to start with. So yeah, I can imagine that person, you know, how drunk they must be already.
Then, of course, there's all the implications for the Tory leadership and whether Boris Johnson will install a pro-Trump fan from the civil service in the White House. I can't imagine there's a massive number to choose
from. One of
from.
The many, many Trump fans in the civil service. I don't know. I think I'm now obsessed with the idea that, because like Theresa May technically can still pick the person because she's still prime minister. Ollie Robbins, the obvious choice.
It's always a bit strange that the US just picks people for political reasons and basically just lines up a load of donors, whereas we have serious career politicians. I think why not just put Simon Cowell in there or something like that, or Piers Morgan, just to troll everyone.
That would be awful. He would enjoy it.
That's true.
No, again, Ollie Robbins, I think, is the best possible choice. Everyone.
So in terms of maximum trolling, how can you troll the most people in the largest amount?
So I think it's
Ollie Robbins.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I mean, obviously, you know, this is up for discussion. If you have a better suggestion, can say, but yesterday, I spent most of my day yesterday thinking of who would be the funniest appointment, and that was my conclusion.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. We're all going to be supporting Ollie Robbins as the new US ambassador. Our guest this week is none other than the political scientist Sir John Curtis. Sir John, welcome.
You're welcome.
Sir John, should I call you Sir John or no, Your Grace?
No, you shouldn't. No, John is perfectly fine.
So we were discussing it. If we were to use it, would it be Sir Professor or Professor Sir?
It's Professor Sir. If you really wish to know.
Oh, we do.
No, if you shouldn't really, right? Okay, it is Professor Sir John Curtis. So you can either, if you wish to address me formally, you can either go Professor Curtis or Sir John. I mean, those are the two forms. I don't think anybody's invented a short form for Professor Sir John Curtis. So why don't we just stick with John? Yeah, you know, it's much simpler.
Professor Sir.
I travel incognito. I do not declare my... position.
I doubt you truly travel incognito, John. But we'll come on to that. We'll come on to that later. John is Professor of Politics at the University of Strathclyde, a senior fellow at the National Centre for Survey Research, but arguably most famous as the face of the exit poll at general elections. And I'd like to start by asking you about that. Obviously, you are an academic primarily. So, would you describe yourself as a pollster?
No.
Because some do.
I know.
How does that sit?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, insofar, it depends. You have to define what I mean. I take a pollster to somebody who was responsible for the commissioning and conduct of commercial opinion polls. I do survey research with Nuts and Social Research, but I obviously manage all the fieldwork, etc. But I get involved on the design side. So to that extent, I certainly do things that pollsters would also do. But, you know, most of what I have to say about the state of the parties, et cetera, is, frankly, I feed off you lot. I mean, I basically I'm just simply sad enough to take the tables that you're forced to put on the web and spend a little while looking at them and make some sense out of them. The nearest thing I'm involved in politics, I guess, is the exit poll.
And the exit poll is, of course, a very different beast.
Which is actually managed because it's a multi-company thing. I mean, so... you say I'm the face of the exit poll. I'm the face of the exit poll for the BBC, but Colin Rowlings is the face of the exit poll for ITV, and Mike Thrasher is the face of the exit poll for Sky. And we, all of us, are responsible for the academic direction. There are then lots of clever people who are responsible for the analysis. And then, you know, Nick Moon, formerly of NOP and now with his own company, and people at Ipsos Mori are kind of crucial for conducting the fieldwork, and a lot of the fieldwork design is particularly been the product of Nick Moon's work. So, you know, it's a whole teamwork exercise, but I don't know, somehow or another people have associated. I mean, I guess I'm the person who's daft enough to AIP on BBC, which gets the biggest audience. But of course, remember, I'm not the face in the sense, remember, I am not in studio at 10 o'clock on exit poll night. It's David Dimbleby who is the true face of the exit poll for the BBC, or has been, because he's the person who announced the result. I get dragged on when I finally get to studio, which more recently has been at Elstree, which is quite a journey, and get dragged on and go, so how the devil did you come up with that result then, kind of tone. Thereafter, I'm the person who, as it were, whose egg would be on my face if we get it wrong, which we're bound to do at some point.
How did you first become involved in it, and when?
Okay, the history is as follows. Back in 1979, I was a graduate student of David Butler's.
At Nuffield College
in Oxford. And David was, and had been since the 1950s, the face of British election night television. I mean, once upon a time, the thing that David was famous for, he did it incredibly quickly, was, you know, resorting from Torbay, the swing was 2% to the Conservatives. That is a low swing for a constituency where the Liberal Democrat, were fighting. And he used to have an army of Nuffield students with slide rules to work these things out very quickly. Well, by 1979, we had computers. But David,
not the kind we have nowadays, kids. But
No. Big mainframe computers that were not always reliable. And shall we say, David decided that, well, actually, I'm not quite sure that I trust this. So he was allowed two people behind him to support him. The other was Brian Gostalk, by the way, who went on to become chairman of Ipsos Mori for a while. And our job was, you know, A, that, you know, there was a mainframe computer, which did all sorts of analysis. But I was also charged with the task of programming a programmable calculator, because in those days you could have calculators that you could program in BASIC or whatever it was, and I'd learned some programming, so that if the computer system were to crash, I could still calculate the swing very quickly. So that's where it's... So my first experience was being behind the scenes, basically supporting David Butler in what eventually proved to be his last general election on the telly. So that was my entree into BBC television. But there was then a second crucial player, because then in 1981, Clive Payne, who people will not be aware of, but Clive Payne was the person, or one of two people, who was responsible for doing the prediction programme for the BBC.
Yeah, I mean, you say as if people at home will not have heard of the British Election Information and Prediction System.
Well, I've got a poster of him on my wall.
But, you know, I mean, Clive had done the programme.
And his son, Tom. I mean,
So the point was that Sir Clive was also part of the BBC crew. And in 1981, we persuaded the BBC for its coverage of the then Greater London Council elections, so local elections, that we would turn up with a Research Machines 380Z. This guy's is the first microcomputing before the IBM PC was invented, right? That we would bring a computer with this, which was programmed in BASIC, and if they gave us the results, we would be able to feed them not only the result for each of the wards of the Greater London Council, but also kind of overall tally. So we did that, and then in 1982, we did local elections. So, and then, sorry, there's a bit more to this. Then in 1983, we persuaded the BBC that if we had an acoustic coupler connection to the BBC, to the mainframe of Oxford University. So this is going down a telephone line at about 300 bits per second. Right?
Like the VIDI printer on the football results.
That we would...
Marie's just looking at us. I'm really enjoying this trip down memory.
I was just thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner. It's all good. Continue.
Well, sorry, it is a rather long story before you get to the point of the exit poll. That started what I still do for the BBC, which is the results come in, they're fed in, and we analyse them as they come in, and we say the Labour Party's doing well in working class areas or middle class areas or badly in Scotland or whatever. All that analysis, which is kind of, you know, my principle. So I had that role. Now, during this time, and again, I've forgotten the exact sequence, but the BBC at this in the 1980s, rather than doing an exit poll, was into doing a on-the-day poll with Gallup. And Ivor Crewe was particularly responsible for this. And that worked for a while, and then it didn't work. So they dropped that idea, and then we started working the idea of an exit poll, and I forgot when the first one was. It's either, I think it's probably 1992 that we first did something, and Nick Moon was doing it for NLP. So basically, by this stage, what you have to understand is I was part of the furniture, right?
And like but the one in 92, and the one, and they did it for separate broadcasters.
That's correct. And the BBC did its own. It's often thought to have been bad. It wasn't as bad as people thought. People seem to think it predicted Labour majority. Actually, it predicted a hung parliament, but with Labour, I think, very slightly ahead. But anyway, at that point, I was certainly... given they dropped the idea of Gallup, we, by this stage, were into the scene of analysing data live for the BBC. We kind of inherited the job of analysing the exit poll data for the BBC. So that's I kind of slid into it from one role into another. And then basically more recently, the BBC and the companies came together. But then the other crucial thing is that those exit polls were not entirely successful. But then David Firth at the University of Warwick persuaded me, and then we persuaded the BBC, that we should change the way that we did the exit poll. And that rather than trying to come up with a representative sample of polling stations, give up on that diet. It's impossible to do under the British system because we don't have polling centre counts. Now, basically, you just go back to the same places you did last time. You use the exit poll to estimate change in vote share rather than level in vote share. And the crucial observation is that the change in vote share does not vary as much as the level of vote share from place to place. Therefore, there is a greater probability of getting it right. And you take that information and you model it. And that's been the basis of what we've done since 2005. And since we've been doing it that way, the exit polls have been, remarkably successful. So that's the story. Basically, so I got my feet under the floor for doing one thing, and then I got my feet, I got them continued because Clive Payne then kind of took me on and got me in. So I became part of the BBC production team, And then, as it were, because I was part of that team, when the BBC decided to start doing its own exit polls, and I was kind of the person who was analysing stuff for them, I kind of inherited that role.
And I guess I do have another question, which I'm not sure how interesting it will be for other people, but I'm French. And obviously, you know, we do have quite good exit polls that are quite quick for French presidential elections as well. So how has there ever been any sort of international cooperation in terms of finding out? Because obviously models change from one country to the other.
There's been a bit. There was actually a conference in Brussels a few years ago that an Irish political scientist organised, in which we did kind of all get together and shared what we did. We were the only ones doing what we did. And I've, in fact, been involved, again, via Nick Moon, with exit polls in Greece until all the broadcasters decided to get together. At one stage, there were about six separate exit polls in Greece. And
polling in Greece is not straightforward, as anyone in the industry knows.
But for an exit poll, it's a lot easier than here, because the crucial thing to realise, there are two things about the way in which we organise elections in this country that makes life difficult. The first is that we poll on a working day. So therefore, most of the votes are cast between about 5 and 7 in the evening, all right? Whereas if you go to most European countries, they vote on a Sunday.
Yes, we're more
civilised. Most people vote in the morning. So therefore, you've got all afternoon to sit there and analyse the data and work out what you're going to say by 6, 7 or 8 o'clock, whatever time it is the polls decide to close. Whereas we don't. We basically have to work out how we're going to model the data on the basis of the people who vote in the morning, and hope to God we don't miss anything later in the day. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, which is really unique, we're a very peculiar country in that we think it is safer to take a whole load of ballot boxes and ship them around the country to central polling stations, and that there is no way that they're going to get lost or captured or whatever, rather than counting the votes in the polling station before you transmit them on to anywhere else. And this all goes back to Victorian attempts to achieve the secrecy of the ballot. So therefore, we don't have counts in the polling stations, which most countries do. Therefore, you don't know how a polling station has voted previously. Therefore, it is very, very difficult to come up with a sample of polling stations that you know was at least representative of how the country voted last time. And therefore, there's a pretty good chance that how people vote in those polling stations this time will be right. So, I mean, and that's the two difficulties we face. And the method that was adopted of focusing on change was designed to get around that second problem. The first one is just, you know, basically after, you know, 6, 7 o'clock in the evening, it's seatbelts on and off we go. And we've lost the time to think. And it's now just hoping that we've spotted what we need to model in order. And usually by that point, we have two or three ways in which we think we might model the data, and then it's just a question of eliminating them as we go along.
And that difference between focusing on change rather than focusing on absolute is what distinguishes an exit poll from a quote-unquote normal opinion poll.
No. What distinguishes an exit poll from a normal poll is that it attempts to ask people how they voted as opposed to how you are going to vote, although I grant you, given that some people vote by post pollsters, will in any other question, and I grant you there are other ways of finding out how people have voted, and occasionally people have used methods like polling people on the day by phone or over the internet and use that in order to forecast what's going on. But the point about an exit poll in particular, it's the idea that you can get the result by standing outside a polling station. That's the exit bit.
Oh, sorry, yes. Right. As opposed to the exit poll.
So you stand outside the polling station, and as people exit the polling station, you poll them for how they have voted. Now, of course, there is another complication which lots of people ask us about, which is that, what about postal votes? Because, of course, now, 15-20% of the vote is cast by vote. There, again, the change thing becomes crucial, because basically the assumption that we make is that whatever change in vote share occurs in the count of the people who have turned up to vote in person will be replicated amongst those who voted by post in that polling station. All right, that's an assumption we have to make. So far, we've not been too far off. But exit polling in the UK is a unique challenge. Though, to be honest, however, the idea of and of course, we also have an electoral system whereby small errors get magnified enormously. And of course, what's also true, again, if you go to Greece, I mean, they cover themselves very carefully. They'll say, you know, we think it's going to be, you know, between 39.9% and 43.8% for party A and between 37.6% and 40.1% for party B. So therefore, you know, we don't necessarily know who's going to win, all right?
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No, well, you know, sure, you and I would agree on that, but of course, that's not the culture we have. And
doesn't please broadcast.
We therefore come up with point estimates, although the grammar that we have developed, so for example, the headline for the most recent poll in 2017 was Conservatives' largest party, all right? And that was intended to convey that, you know what, we think the Tories are the largest party. We don't know whether they've got an overall majority or not. We did not say this was a hung parliament.
I do remember that split second really, really well, actually, of watching, I think, the New Statesman Party, and that kind of appeared on the screen, and everyone had a second of, hang on, because, yeah, it didn't say overall majority, and then obviously, you know, the numbers kind of came on, but the phrasing was really interesting.
But the point is, we weren't ruling out an overall majority, right?
Because in 2015... Conservatives' largest party meant that they went on to get a majority.
They did, though actually the exit poll only had them at 317 or whatever it was. Yeah, no, exactly, yeah.
Quite remarkable, this exit poll. The Conservatives on 360.
We're joined again by Simon Gentry, who leads the public affairs practice in Newgate. Hello, Simon.
Hi.
Now, this week, we're going to discuss the fines that have been doled out to both Marriott and British Airways for violation of data protection. Tell us about this.
So the Information Commissioner has new powers as of May last year under the European regulation, and they have now fined around £300 million worth of fines have been imposed on BA and Marriott, which are pretty amazing numbers when you think about the sheer value that's taking out of the share price and indeed the profitability of these companies. I wonder if this will drive a sea change in attitudes within companies in terms of the data that they hold on us and the way they treat it. But also as individuals, you begin to wonder, well, I wonder how much information I've got on friends and colleagues and things I ought to be protecting in a different way.
What interests me about these particular cases is these are hundreds of millions of pounds in fines, as you say. But in both cases, this wasn't a specific mistake by the companies themselves. This wasn't them leaving the data on a train, as indeed civil servants have done in the past. This is, in both cases, they were hacked and that data was then released. And in the case of Marriott, a company they bought was hacked before they bought it, and now they've been fined as a result. Now, you can claim that's a mistake in due diligence, but is there much that can be done about this? And will it perhaps lead in future to companies not reporting hacks for fear of then getting slapped with a £100 million fine?
Certainly, that looks like a logical conclusion of this particular regulation, and it may be that in time we work out that it's not exactly fit for purpose. But the reality is, at the moment, we are in a wild west when it comes to data. Nobody really understands where the boundaries are. The data that companies hold sometimes can be incredibly useful, important, valuable, but also very personal, intimate data. And so we're in a totally new situation, and we're all kind of figuring out how this new world works. But for the meantime, there are these huge threats out there for companies. Certainly, there's a due diligence issue. There's also an issue about how companies think about the way they gather data, the way they process data. I mean, if I'm organizing an event of some sort, very often I'll just take the names and emails of people I think would be interested in coming to an event, put in a list and email them. But, you know, now we have to go through a whole other procedure to work out whether they actually want to be emailed.
And this is all a result of GDPR.
This is all part of the General Data Protection Directive, which is a directive that came into force in May last year, and not only powered up the Information Commissioner in the UK, but right the way across the EU. France has levied quite big fines. Facebook had a huge fine last year, but nothing on the scale of what potentially could happen now. Some of these giant companies, the Facebooks and companies like that, that hold lots of personal data, they could be fined billions of pounds.
And where does this money go?
The money actually goes to Treasury, which is kind of interesting because you do wonder if there are conflicts there. Sometimes governments make laws and then they actually benefit from them financially.
Shall we raise taxes or shall we just fine lots of companies?
Exactly. I love the idea of Philip Hammond trying to become sort of like GDPR spy and seeing sort of like where the breaches of data are.
I did actually wonder whether perhaps government has exempted itself, because you can imagine the NHS has huge amounts of data. I think of my doctor who behind the reception has a whole bunch of files which frankly anybody could jump over and get hold of.
Simon, do you have a favourite example of data breaching?
Because I do.
Tell us about your one, Joe.
Yeah, it's one of those questions that you ask. Was there a famous time you fell off a ladder and landed in a bath? My favourite example of data breaching, since you asked, was the Wi-Fi-enabled vibrators in Canada that were their users were hacked. And so not only were the address details and emails of the vibrator users compromised, but also the number of times and the times and dates that the vibrators had been used were released. I mean, compared to that, I think someone finding out your credit card details and your Marriott loyalty card number is relatively minor. This was in Canada, and the company were fined again quite substantially.
You can imagine some of the dating apps which have enormous amounts of extremely personal information must be absolutely quaking in their boots at the moment.
What's really interesting about the vibrator issue, since you asked, is that in that case, it wasn't the money that was given to the Treasury. As I say, this was in Canada. It was given to the users of the vibrator in compensation.
That feels all right, then.
I think that sounds a really good idea,
I was going to say, it strikes me that that would be a more palatable position to adopt than giving the money to the Treasury.
Yeah, one of the things that strikes me about this is they haven't actually proven any harm. So you're kind of being fined for something where no apparent harm has actually occurred. And so I do wonder in law whether that's a really good idea. And if harm has been caused, then people, the victims, not to be compensated.
Simon Gentry, thank you.
Thank you.
So you've been involved in these polls for a long time. What has been the most surprising result that you've experienced? And surprising in the sense of different from how you expected it to be before the results started to come in?
I guess probably the most surprising one was the way in which the Liberal Democrat vote did not come through in the 2010 election.
That's the Paddy Ashdown offering to eat his trousers or his hat?
More than once. Paddy's got form. He eventually learned his lesson. But yeah, so if you remember in 2010, we had Cleggmania, and the polls had seen Liberal Democrat vote rise in the wake of Nick Clegg's performance in the first leadership debate. It was clearly falling away. But shall we say, I don't think I was expecting that we would end up forecasting the Democrats would end up with fewer seats. So to that extent, at least, that's the one that probably scratched our heads most about. But however, we looked at the data and we looked at it and we looked at it and we were like, it's perfectly obvious. And in the end, we actually underestimated the Liberal Democrats. Actually, we overestimated them very slightly. I think we said 59, they got 57 or whatever it was. So that's probably not, I mean, if we'd said 67, I would have been going, well, OK, fine, you know, it's largely disappeared. 2017 certainly wasn't a surprise for me. It seemed to me, given the range of evidence that we had available to us from the polls, that anything between the Tories just losing their majority, maybe getting majority 60, was within the range of the possible. And you just saw the numbers go and you saw the pattern in the voting. You went, yeah, sure, you know, it's right. I guess 2015 was perhaps the most audacious, but I guess I certainly would not have said that I was clear that the polls were wrong in 2015. So I guess that probably also counts as a fair bit of surprise. But again, you know, the polls, the numbers didn't have to be that far out before you would get the Tories to the kind of numbers we were talking about. Yeah, the Lib Democrat one is probably the biggest surprise. But of course, you know, we've got form. Three times in a row we've told people that it's not what you thought it was going to be. And we've been lucky in that we've been closer than everybody else. So everybody thinks we're right. But of course, you know, you could say, look, these guys have asked people how they voted. Now, they've asked people how they voted. They asked God, many thousands of people, how they voted. Surely to God, they should be able to get it roughly right. And you could, you know, people say this is a great prediction. Of course, it's not a prediction. It's, you know, we've asked people on the day how they've actually voted, and we've just simply aggregated it up in a certain way in order to work out what we think the outcome is going to be. It's not exactly the world's greatest prediction.
So I guess doing what you do, I'm kind of interested in what you make of media coverage, especially at election time. How tied do you think it is to actually the way the polls are going? And on the other way as well, can you see the polls changing depending on how, I guess, the media narrative can shift during election campaigns?
Well, of course, this is a subject of some controversy and dispute. So, I mean, I think the truth is the media kind of move in and out of the polls in the sense that, you know, after 2015, there was a lot of, we'll never let the polls determine the narrative again, and that we spent far too much time arguing about what would happen in a hung parliament. I think actually that is wrong. Even the polls have been right, we would have still been talking about a hung parliament, because half the polls would have still pointed towards a hung parliament. But that's another story. Right? But there certainly was more emphasis than might otherwise have been the case. And therefore, they kind of shied away. But, you know, the truth is that by the time of the EU referendum, the media at the end of the day are desperate to be able to anticipate what the next move is going to be, what the politicians are going to do.
Which is why we have the exit poll at all.
Yeah, sure, of course, because why bother to tell people at 10 o'clock what they're going to know by about 6 hours later anyway?
For many hundreds of thousands of pounds.
Yeah, sure. And so, you know, the truth is that for all its limitations, you know, polling is their best guide. So you saw, for example, in the recent European Parliament election. Now, you know, the polls weren't entirely clear, but, you know, the fact that Nigel Farage is doing terrible things to the Conservative Party's vote, which became a crucial part of the narrative, the way in which that came from the polls. And although the polls were all entirely agree with each other, they certainly were all of them saying enough about what was going on to the Remain vote to say, hang on, there's a bit of a battle going on here for second place. So again, that narrative is quite a lot of the narrative of the EP election was to some degree certainly informed by, you know, certainly informed by the polls. So, I mean, the truth is with the BBC, I mean, ever since the days of John Burt running the organisation, basically you don't determine the top of the 10 o'clock news by the latest poll says. And the BBC, I think, has been bitten, you know, about that. It's still often pretty reticent about the reporting of poll results, but, you know, usually some rather down the running order, if it's merit, if it's important, if it seems to be telling certain moves the story, then at least a correspondent will mention it, even if it's only in, well, these folks say this and I'll let you decide whether you're going to believe it or not kind of tone. But it does inevitably still inform how people report and think about the moves. I mean, at the moment, you know, we're all speculating about whether or not if Boris Johnson becomes the next Prime Minister, to what extent, if at all, will the Brexit Party vote goes down, the Tory vote goes up, all right? And the fact that we're even asking that question is, frankly, the product of polling information.
I imagine that some of our younger listeners at home will be wondering how they get to work on the exit poll team. What would be your piece of advice, your one piece of advice for someone who...
All those very, very cool listeners that we have.
Well, now, rightly or wrongly, there is a crucial rule about broadcast media, which is that if you have developed a reputation for having done it okay in the past, if in particular you've developed a reputation that if a camera crew turns up with a camera and they've got 10 minutes to do an interview before they get back to the edit suite in order to get it on the air in 40 minutes time, they know they want you to do it on the first take, okay? And you'll be coherent and clear. So, and what I'm saying is that therefore reputation is crucial. Has the Post ever been advertised through, you know, Equalities? No. Rightly or wrongly, no. As you would have gathered from the story I told you, and I had to tell you the story I told you earlier, is that basically I had a supervisor who had been in the BBC for 30 years, who, by the way, himself got introduced by the BBC by the guy who wrote the 1945 Nuffield study and who'd been asked by the BBC to do something. So, you know, it's a chain of people of no spirit. And the people who are currently involved in the exit poll team, well, it's basically people who are either Clive Payne, you know, I have known in the first instance, so that's how Steve Fisher got involved. Steve and I have both been involved with Rob Ford, and that's how Rob got invited. More recently, then, we've had people both that worked with Rob or people who've worked with Steve. So it's literally, it's connections, rightly or wrongly, because we are looking for people that we know that have a certain set of skills, who can get involved in teamwork, etc. And that's just more broadly true. So the answer is, I'm afraid so far at least, rightly or wrongly, it's been to know the right people.
At the last election, Simon Hicks from the LSE produced a list of various people's seat predictions. And this was everything from academics and statistical modelling to someone like Ian Dale and his predictions going through seat by seat. And all you needed to do was put a public prediction out there. What struck me that was interesting about that really long list was that only two of the people involved were women, and they were both part of wider teams that were making estimates. What's your take on women in political polling and why there aren't more?
Oh, I think it's one of the, like many other areas of life, it's an area that's gradually being feminized. So if we think about, there's a quasi-academic conference called EPOP, which not
the
only...
Glastonbury of the political science world.
The Glastonbury of the political science view. You know, but the nice thing about it, it's not just academic political science to turn up, but it's also, you know, people from the polling world, and even occasionally you get a real politician or party strategist or whatever. Now, when that first started in, Lord knows, late 80s, early 90s, whenever it was, there were very few women who were involved. And you know, point was, women did sociology, men did political science. Right? It's a classic kind of gender division of labour. But now, well, if it's not 50% female, it's almost 50% female, I think. Now, I guess what it will be true is, because of that history, they are disproportionately younger and maybe therefore less likely to be known. And of course, what is also true is that, you know, the incentives for people to do what I do, which is to spend time talking to the media, you know, despite the impact bit of ref, they're not what they were. I mean, there is still, above all, the requirement to be able to publish in high quality academic journals that nobody reads.
Yeah, ref is the research excellence framework.
Sure, yeah. So, and junior colleagues in particular are kind of, you know, particularly under pressure to do that. So again, expect to do that. But then, given you've raised this issue occasionally, also we've been accused, you know, the exit poll team is all male. Well, actually,
that was an accusation levelled at you after the PSA awards.
Well, indeed. Well, it's not wholly correct in that in the 2014 European Parliament election, one of the analysis team of which the exit poll team is part was female. And indeed, this time for the European Parliament election, Rob Ford was not available. And we indeed, his replacement was a woman. So
that doesn't quite work, saying, you know, quite, like, it's not, quite, you know, there was one man who couldn't make it, therefore replacing him with one woman.
Well, but the point is that, I mean, I think it's a way of illustrating this was actually a relatively junior person. She's still a PhD student, but the point is that because the profession has become feminized, that insofar as the role that we are talking about is one that you're likely going to get a relatively junior person to do, it's just an anecdotal illustration of the broader point about the feminization of the profession. And I would be, you know, I mean, and Jane Green is now doing ITV, yep, right? And it's going to be Colin Rowling's replacement. So again, there's another example of how actually, as we move into the next generation, I mean, my generation, it was all male, all right, or virtually all male. There was one person who was a well-known academic political scientist, and she went off to the States and made a very high-flying career there. So it was, you know, it was literally predominantly male. But that's all over. So therefore, I think, frankly, you should expect to find, insofar as there are academics on the media talking about polls and polling and elections, etc., etc., you should over time indeed see more women. And, you know, you may even find that actually you get an all-female studio. Who knows?
And in fact, political polling as an industry is, I would argue, no better. I would say the proportions are probably similar and the situation is similar in that the women that are coming into the industry tend to be younger.
Yeah, but the point is, but the professions are being feminized. Yeah. And that so long as those women stay in the profession now, you know, and leaving aside arguments about whether or not women are always adequately promoted or not, but the honest truth is, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I'm just trying to think of all the principal polling companies. I'm not sure that any of them at the moment is headed by a woman.
Well, Deborah Mattinson.
Yes, that's true. Deborah Mattinson has her own company.
Not really a political pollster.
No, that's true. So Deborah is the nearest, and she has a public face, and she does quite a lot of media work. But I guess, you know, at some point we should anticipate that YouGov or Delta Poll or Ipsos Mori or somewhere like that will be headed by a woman. Because certainly, again, in the world, you know, the social research world, very heavily female, though I think it's what's also true there is at the moment the top still tends to be male. But, you know, presumably at some point it's going to be feminized. Indeed, I mean, most of the people I'm working with on British social, I'm in the minority, right? Okay. I mean, it's predominantly female, including, you know, female-led.
John, you told The Spectator that you have, quote, no wish to become a media celebrity. Well, good news, you've definitely come to the right place. But obviously, you have attracted, I think, what is best described as a cult following. I think personified by the Is John Curtis on TV Twitter feed. How does that feel?
I wear it lightly. I like, you know, I mean, people come up to me and say, you know, and ask for selfies and all the rest of it. I mean, I just do it and move on. Okay. I mean, you know.
Was it something you ever expected to happen?
No, good Lord, no. You must be joking. No, absolutely not. No intention or whatever. But, you know, it so happens to be the case that, you know, I've always regarded as doing this kind of thing as part of the job of being an academic political scientist who does voting behaviour. And it seems to be the case that somehow or another people find what I say interesting, but I move on.
You don't have a personal Twitter account, do you? But you do. You are obviously involved.
I have two institutional accounts, both of which support websites that I run that own information things. Now, I don't use Twitter in order to express. I never express my personal views, as you know, and I certainly don't use Twitter to get involved. I basically use Twitter in order to find out what polls have been coming out, to follow some people whose views are interesting, which I might wish to read, and in order to tell people about material that I've put up. I mean, I think the story of the Is John Curtis on TV Twitter feed goes back to the 18th of April 2017, which is the day that the Prime Minister called the election. And it was the day after Easter, and I was sitting in Natsen's office in Edinburgh looking for a nice quiet day to write something rather up. And I got rung up by the BBC News channel and say, the Prime Minister's about to make an announcement. We're not quite sure what it's about, but the rumour is it might be about an election. So, you know, are you available? I said, well, yeah, you know, I'm sitting in Edinburgh. It's about, you know, 10 minutes ride from the Edinburgh studio, which, by the way, is, you know, very small. And in the end, I'm denied. I said, I tell you what, get me a cab. I'll go down to the studio. If it's about something else, I'll just quietly go and walk back again. And if it is about an election, I'll be there. Well,
were you there for the next seven days?
Yeah, I was basically there for the next few hours. And the point was that, you know, I doubtless people saying, why is this guy on the television all the time? And it was because, of course, I was in a television studio at the crucial moment. Indeed, eventually I managed to escape for an hour to go and basically pick up my belongings from where I had left them and came back again. But I even had, I mean, you know, very rare, I even had to organise a pool interview. So, you know, both ITV Border and STV wanted something. And I said, look, could one of you come and I'll go and walk outside the BBC and I'll do it for you. But I haven't got time to both do you and them because I've got to. So, yeah, that was absolutely frenetic. And I'm sure it's somebody who going, why
you,
that?
You don't know who, you don't know
I
who
have
it is.
No idea who it is and I don't care who it is, but I suspect it's somebody who went, why the hell is he on all the, you know, all the time? You know, haven't got anybody else who's got anything to say. And of course, you know, the brutal truth is that, you know, the other thing about access to the media is if you want to be involved in the media, don't live too far away from a television studio. Now, I don't live in London, but I do live quite close to the BBC studios in Glasgow. And of course, it's a lot easier to get across Glasgow than it is across London. So I can probably, you know, if I'm staying at my daughter's in East Dulwich, it's much more difficult to get the BBC than if I'm staying at home going to Pacific Quay. So being close to a studio is obviously also. Though again, that's got easier. I mean, I've done two interviews in the last 24 hours, albeit for radio, just standing in the street, you know, shouting at my laptop or whatever. So access has got easier with the internet, but there's still a preference for some programmes that are kind of regard themselves rather highly to always have people preferably in their studio and certainly in a studio.
And finally, John, do you ever eat out in a restaurant on your own?
Yes.
Marie, what about you?
Oh, yeah, no, I think I probably slightly prefer going to the restaurant by myself.
And what proportion of the British public do you think say that they don't eat in a restaurant alone?
I mean, I famously think that the British public are cowards. So I would say probably quite a high number. It's probably around, I don't know, I'm going to say 67% of people would say they don't eat.
Well, I would have said about 70, so we're roughly in agreement.
Oh, well, and the true answer is between both of your predictions, 68%.
Well, there we go. So we're clearly pretty good. That, if I may say so, is probably better than one of Joe's polls. So.
oh, don't worry, we'll edit that out. We won't, will we? No. Only 2% say they eat out on their own frequently, and a further 27% say they eat out occasionally on their own.
No, of course, because a lot of people won't be able to afford to eat out a restaurant at all. And B, most people, when they eat out a restaurant, will do so for social occasions. Why do I eat out occasionally on my own? Well, because I find myself in London or wherever. I'm away from my wife and I want something to eat.
Oh, yeah. I'm the same.
No, so whereas I think I just really don't enjoy it when I'm eating something really, really nice and people are talking to me while I'm eating it. I genuinely quite enjoy it.
That's a whole different dimension.
That's more unusual.
But the question didn't look at that. John Curtis, thank you so much for joining us on Polling Politics this week. And thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to Simon Gentry from Newgate. And we'll speak to you all again next week. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.